Good afternoon. So last time we started off by reviewing the processor design of the sort we learned in CS01, at least I think we learned in CS01, something I called a single cycle design because we kind of had all our different steps of the instruction, and every clock cycle, each instruction went through each of those steps, and only after all those steps were done did we go on to the next instruction. And we mentioned that this kind of had this inefficiency in that, you know, it meant that kind of the first part of our instruction, like fetching it from the instruction cache, you know, only did some work a small portion of the time. And the whole rest of the time, that physical component of the hardware would be kind of doing nothing. And our fix for this was to implement this idea we called pipelining, where if we had a sequence of instructions A, B, C, we'd have one instruction, say instruction A, in stage 3, while the next instruction B would be in stage 2, while we're doing stage 1 for instruction C, and so on. And every clock cycle, we'd advance all the instructions to the next stage. And if we had, for example, 5 stages, this means we'd be executing parts of 5 instructions at once. And we looked a little about, well, how does this change our performance? And we said it increases our throughput. And this was a measure where we said, well, how often do we actually finish instructions or start instructions? Those are the same thing, kind of in the big picture, because, you know, in order to run a billion instructions, we need to both start and finish them. So we had this throughput, which is the rate at which instructions finish. We also mentioned that if we were kind of just looking naively and saying, well, the instruction takes as long as from when we start it to when we finish it, well, that measure would say that this pipelining idea was in fact less efficient. But the time from the beginning of the instruction to the end would generally be larger, because we added some extra components to do pipelining, and we have these costs from our pipeline stages not kind of dividing up the work exactly evenly in practice. Now, another kind of trade-off we made with pipelining, besides that, like, well, we couldn't get kind of the ideal throughput increase, we got a throughput increase because things weren't divided up evenly, and we have this extra cost for these pipeline registers, was that, well, it turns out that just doing pipelining doesn't run some programs correctly. And we called this problem hazards. And we talked about two types of hazards and started talking about sort of fixes for both of them. So one type of hazards was what we call a control hazard, that our pipelining idea depended on us always starting the next instruction immediately after we do the first step of the previous one. But with something like a conditional jump, this isn't really possible. We have to figure out where does the jump go, which is like the work of actually doing that jump, before we can fetch the correct next instruction. And we arrived at a fix for this, which is that, well, we can't fetch the correct thing all the time, but we can make a guess. So we'll make some guess and start running those instructions that we guess. So we'll choose an instruction that could follow our conditional jump, start running it, and keep running more instructions from that part of the program. And eventually, we'll actually do the work of computing where did that conditional jump really go. And at that point, we have two cases. So our simple case is it goes to exactly the place we guessed. In that case, we don't have to do any extra work. We're just done. And we just say, great. The, you know, more complicated case is, well, we figure out, oh, it goes to some other place we guessed wrong. In that case, we need to undo our guesses. And it turned out for the pipelines we were looking at, how did we undo our guesses? Well, those instructions didn't get very far. They were just in the first couple stages. So we could basically just discard the temporary values we computed for them and replace them with instructions that do nothing. And at that point, after we discard the mispredicted, the wrong guess instructions, then we can figure out where the jump was supposed to go and start fetching those instructions. That was how we dealt with control hazards. So for data hazards, we had a different problem. So data hazards, as I mentioned on this slide, is when we don't have a value in time. So the problem isn't that we don't know what instructions to fetch, we fetch the correct instructions. The issue is that the instruction tells us to add a value that hasn't been written back to registers yet. And we've talked about two solutions, and it turns out we're going to use both of them together. But two solutions, and the first one, the easier to implement one, is this idea of stalling. And that's that we say, well, if the value isn't written or available yet, let's wait until it is. And when we wait until it is, we just hold the instruction in whatever stage they're in, and that means all the instructions behind them have to stay. We'll see some examples of this later today. Delay them until the value is ready, then proceed. So when we do that, we're not getting our full throughput. We're running fewer instructions per unit time. But at least we're computing the right answer. That's probably more important. An observation we made at the end of last time is that even if the value isn't written to the registers yet, it might still be available. So we don't actually need to wait for it to be completely written and updating the registers. We could get the value early. And this idea is called forward, where we kind of look at our circuit and say, where is the value going to be? And we add an extra wire so we can take that value from where it is and have it replace the incorrect value we would have read from the registers. And that idea is called forwarding. We'll look at that more as our first topic for today. So before I do that, sort of questions about things we covered last time. Yes?
Is the control hazard shit always in the homework where the backwards always taken?
So question, for the control hazard, when we're doing branch prediction, how do we predict what the next instruction to run is? So there is an incredible variety that is used in practice. The strategy in the homework is probably the best strategy if you don't want to store information to do the prediction. Modern sort of laptop, desktop, and mobile phone processors generally have some sort of cache-like data structure where they record what recently happened when we did jumps and use that to make a better prediction. But obviously, that's a lot more complicated to implement than the strategy in the homework where we just have to look at the jump instruction and nothing else. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's go on to talk more about forwarding. So last time we mentioned that forwarding dealt with this issue of when we have this use of R9, where this first ad here is writing a value. Is writing a value to R9. And if we kind of let this execute normally, it's going to read the kind of old value of R9, even though we've computed the new value. But when we were reading from the registers, the old value is what was there. And the new value is not actually going to be written back for a while. So what we can do is we can say, we're getting this old value right here. And we know because the next instruction's destination register is R9, that the new value, is just coming out of that math unit there. So let's take that value from the math unit and use it in place of the old value we got from the registers. And to actually implement this, we of course don't always want to take that quote unquote new value, because it only works if the prior instruction is actually writing to the same register we're reading, and that's not always true. So we'll have a mux, and we'll have some logic where we compare the register numbers from the instructions and decide which of the options do we use for each instruction. Now, in this particular example, we knew the value was in the execute stage because, well, when here we're in decode, the previous instruction's in execute. So that's why my extra wire goes from execute to decode. But that won't always be the case. So for example, here we have the same problem. We have R9 that is being computed by the first add, being something we want to send to the second add, and it's not going to be written to the registers early enough. And what we can think about for, you know, where things are in the pipeline is, well, when we're decoding here, which is, remember, is register read, well, our no-op instruction is in the execute stage, and we have a value in the memory stage. And if we remember how our memory stage works, well, it's where the data cache is, but that instruction doesn't use the data cache, so we're just passing this value through without changing it. But if we want to get the value, it's going to be in the memory stage when we're in the decode stage in the second add. So that's going to be a different wire we want to add, and we can add that wire. So here I add, you know, my value. It's, you know, I don't want this value. This is from the, so in our, we have the second add is in decode. We have our not in execute, and we have our first add is in the memory stage. We want the value from the first add being sent to the second add, so the wire we need to add for that goes from memory to decode. And that means our MUX has more choices, and it turns out that this means that implementing this forwarding involves a lot of cases and a lot of comparisons, but it's worth doing because the cost of the alternative is pretty high. Right? The alternative is that we just don't start a new instruction. Yes, we're going to make the cycle time slightly slower to implement all this logic, but that's going to be way better than needing to stall all the time. So questions on sort of what's going on in this sort of why we have multiple cases for when we need to forward. Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So I have a sequence of instructions here, and I've shown kind of how they would naturally flow through our pipeline. So we're going to fetch the first one, then the second, then the third, you know, one cycle after the other. And I'm assuming by writing the way I've written this that we don't need to do any stalling, which turns out to be correct in this case. We'll talk about cases where we need to do stalling on the next slide. And we don't need to do stalling because, well, we're going to need to do some forwarding here. We have some values that are in common between these instructions, which if we don't do forwarding, we'll read the wrong version. So the question is, where do we have to do forwarding and which forwarding? And for this question, I'm asking sort of about a particular pair of instructions. And I'm asking, is it not forwarded at all? Meaning, do we, you know, take the value from somewhere else, possibly reading it from the register, or possibly forward it in a different way? Or is it forwarded? And we'll assume for this question that we're forwarding to decode from one of the other instructions. And we'll ask which stage of the instruction we're forwarding from. Is it from execute, memory, or write back? I'm assuming we're not forwarding from decode to decode because, yeah, we're not computing any values that early. So we need the value to be available. It's not going to be available before execute. So I have these four questions. Give you a couple minutes to check with your neighbor, see if you agree in what, you know, what forwarding happens, you know, how do we get the values for, in this case, R8 and R9 for all these instructions. We'd like some more time for the first one. In sub-Q, R8 is what relationship to the MQ? Okay, so let's start with who thinks. So for the sub-Q and MQ in R8, the answer is A, it's not forwarded. Okay. B, it's forwarded from execute to the code. C, from memory to the code. D, from write back to the code. No clue. Okay, so mostly A, and that's what I get. So the reason why you might want there to be something going on here is you might say, oh, well, I'm looking at this instruction, that's R8, that's R8. Something needs to happen with R8. But we need to pay attention to what are these instructions actually doing with R8, and in this case, they're just reading R8. They don't modify R8. So we're going to always get the value from either the register file or whatever instructions updating R8. So it is possible R8 needs to be forwarded from some hypothetical, instruction up here that modifies it. Maybe there's some reason it needs to be forwarded, but it definitely doesn't get forwarded from the add because the add isn't modifying it. We're just going to forward things from other instructions that modify it, and if the value in the register file is up to date, we're just going to use that instead of forwarding. Questions? Comments? Yeah, and I guess, and I'm mentioning this explicitly because, it's conceivable we could imagine, saying, oh, well, if the add queue read R8, we could take the value it read instead of reading it again. Indeed, that's, a thing we could physically do. That's generally not something processors are going to do because it ends up being more complicated, and this forwarding logic, is already actually a lot of complication to the processor. Okay, so let's do our next one. In XOR, the R9 is what relationship from the add queue? So who thinks A, it's not forwarded? Okay, how about B, forwarded from execute to the code? Okay, and C, forwarded from memory to the code? And D, forwarded from write back to the code? And no clue? Okay, so we have a bit of a split between B and C. So we've determined, I think most of us have determined at least, that, well, we're modifying R9. We need to get that modified value to the XOR so we can actually do the XOR. So if we think of when values are available, the earliest we can get the value of R9 is at the end of the execute stage. I should say the new R9 is available. And for the XOR, we need it by the beginning of its execute stage. And you might say, based on that, okay, well, we have it in the execute stage of the add, we need it before the execute stage of the XOR, and you're only letting me forward to the code. So let's do, I'll do this. Let's do, forward it from execute to here. That's not what we're going to do, and the problem here is that's time travel. We're saying that we're sending it from the past to the future without something explaining how that happens. And the way we've done our circuits here is we've always kind of made a wire from one stage to another that's going to happen kind of at the same time. There's not a delay on that wire. So even though, yes, the value was originally computed in the execute stage, the place we're going to grab it from the add instruction is from the add instruction it's memory stage. So the add instruction is what's occupying the memory stage. And that's where we're going to grab the value. Yes, the value was computed in the execute stage, but at the time it's computed in the execute stage, we're not ready to forward it yet. So we're going to wait. And when we are ready to forward it, we look for where it happens to be in the pipeline, and it's in the memory stage at that time. Some questions on that idea? So, you know, when we're doing forwarding, we're always taking, you know, the value from the instruction we want, and whatever stage that instruction is in, that's where the value is going to be. You know, even though the value probably often won't have been computed in that particular stage. Yeah?
Can you repeat again the consequence of forwarding it, like to the decode stage and after if you've done executing the first one?
So, can I repeat the consequence of forwarding to the decode stage in what sense? Like why we...
Like why can't you just compute
it? So why can't I take it from execute? So the issue is that if I want to take it from execute, it has to go to something at the same time. So I can send it to the decode stage of sub or the fetch stage of XOR. The XOR isn't in decode yet, so I can't send it to its decode stage at that time. Does that answer your question? So on these diagrams, like when we're drawing forwarding, like I'm always drawing it as a very vertical line because we don't have that sort of, we can't send things to other time cycle numbers. Always has to happen within a cycle. Other questions? Okay, so let's do our next one in the AND queue. R9 is what relationship to the ADD queue? Start with A, who thinks is not forwarded? Okay, over that. How about B, forwarded to decode from execute? C, to decode from memory? And D, to decode from write back? Okay, so we have a split for D or A. Okay, let's do the last one. How about an AND R9 is blank XOR? Same question. So who thinks it's not forwarded? Okay, how about forwarded to decode from execute? Okay, and to decode from memory? To decode from write back? No clue? Okay, so we have a plurality saying that in the AND queue, we're sending the value from the XOR to the AND queue. And agree with that. So the XOR, we compute the XOR value, and we send that to the AND queue just in time for the AND queue to do its computation of the bitwise AND of that XOR value. And if we're doing that, if that's how we're getting the value of R9, we can't be forwarding it from the ADD queue because that would be the wrong version of R9. So in this case, we have multiple options for getting R9, and we choose the one that's the most recent, because that's kind of how we expect assembly to run when we think about it by hand, right? We always have the current version of R9, value of R9. That's what the AND should use, not some older value of R9. You'd be really annoyed if the processor decided that it would sometimes just randomly use the previous RAX for your assembly. So we're not going to do that. And that means we just aren't going to bother grabbing the old value of R9, even though we could, because we don't, it's not useful to us. Some questions? This up here. Yes, back there.
Since we're forwarding the value of R9 from the first ADD queue, is there anything with a process kind of this text that like we're not actually going to need to write that back into main memory?
So the question you have is, In this case, we write R9 and then overwrite R9. So the only value that it seems like we actually need to store to the register file is the second R9. Does the processor make that optimization? I'm not aware of processors with this sort of pipeline design that do that. There's a couple reasons for that. So one is that we have to have the write back stage anyway, because we can't skip it since some instructions need it, so we're gonna wait for them anyways. So we aren't getting rid of a pipeline stage in a useful way by doing that. And we've also accounted for the time to do the write in setting our clock cycle time, and we're not gonna change that sort of on an instruction by instruction basis. So I think that's one big reason. Another big issue is that typically we'll have some mixed instructions that say access memory or something like that. And, or even if we don't, we'll have instructions that could be interrupted by an exception. So accessing memory always can have an exception from a page fault, but other instructions interrupted by exception, if we have an exception, we really want to have written it to the register file. So that's probably a bigger reason why no one's tried to do that optimization. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so if we look at this diagram here, so far it seems like, okay, we do this forwarding, we choose the most recent version of the value, and now that stalling thing you taught us earlier is totally unnecessary. Unfortunately not. So with this kind of five-stage design, we have one case where it's not going to be good enough. So if we think of this move instruction here, this is when the value of RBX is available. It's at the end of the memory stage because we have to access the data cache. And the subtract instruction, this is when the value of RBX is needed. It needs the value to do its math operation in the execute stage. So this just doesn't work. Forwarding's not gonna fix this problem alone. So what we're gonna do is we're still gonna use forwarding, but we need to combine it with stalling to deal with this issue. And for stalling, I'm going to delay the subtract instruction until the value is ready for it. So in this case, my assumption is I figure out in the decode stage, I do the first decode stage, I try to do it, and I say, okay, I need the register's values available for the execute stage in the next cycle. And I say, oh, I can't get them. So we hold the subtract instruction in the decode stage until it's available, and when it's available, the fastest way we can get it is via forwarding, so that's what we do. So I'm forwarding it from memory to decode, rather than waiting for it to actually be written to the register file. So this is combining forwarding and stalling to resolve this problem. Some questions about what's going on in this diagram. Yes?
Sorry, can you re-explain why RBX isn't available?
Question, can I explain why RBX isn't available till here?
Yeah.
So the reason why is if we look at our sort of processor diagram, this is where RBX's value comes out of, the data cache. So the instruction has to make it to the memory stage, and the data cache is going to take some time, so it needs to go through most of the clock cycle in the memory stage for that value to be there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is kind of what we'll do. Something I'll note, especially since it comes up on the homework, if we have an instruction after the subtract, so let's say we have an XOR here, we're going to try to fetch it right away. So we'll fetch it in cycle 2. And it's really tempting to say, well, we just fetched it. Well, we're going to do the decode stage for it next. That's not something we can do because our register file only has so many inputs. So we can't actually put two instructions in the decode stage. We can only read one set of registers at a time. So if we have an instruction following this, it's going to need to repeat. It's going to be sort of held behind. It needs to wait its turn to use the decode stage. So we'll end up with something that looks like this, assuming there's no other reason to stall. And also the instruction after that, right? We can't fetch two things at once. Our instruction cache only has one output. So we're not going to fetch the next instruction, in this case, till cycle 4. Questions? Yes. Yeah?
So after stalling one instruction, the rest of the instructions in the program lock is gone?
Yeah, after stalling one instruction, next in the program also gets stalled. I usually wouldn't use the term saying they also got stalled, but they need to wait for that instruction that was stalled. Does that answer your question? Okay, so from this picture, it might seem like every time we load a value from memory and the next instruction does something with that value, we need to add a stall in this five-stage design. That's not entirely true. There's an exception, and that's the case where we load a value from memory and then immediately store back that value. In this case, the value of RBX is available at the end of cycle 3, sort of this is the output of the data cache, and it's not needed until the beginning of cycle 4 by the next instruction, because it's the input of the data cache for that instruction. So this we can actually resolve without stalling, because we aren't using RBX to compute anything. If we had RBX as part of the address, wouldn't work, right? We need to have the math stuff in the execute stage handle that. But we can actually support this by adding an additional forwarding path. And you might say, gosh, this is sounding kind of complicated. I need to add a whole bunch of extra wires to my processor. And that's true. But most processors that have used this five-stage definer said, well, people write assembly like this often enough, we need to implement this. And so kind of on our processor design here, that would mean we'd be implementing kind of this that shortcut in addition to the other section. So you might say, gosh, if I can forward from the memory stage to somewhere, why, couldn't I just do this shortcut, right? That I just say, well, if I can send something from after the data cache access, and I can send something to here, why can't I send it to here, the end of the execute stage, why can't I send it to the beginning? And we can make this circuit and build a processor that works with that extra shortcut. This is something we will not consider a possible option, even though, yes, this circuit will function. And that's because if we think about what we've built here, well, in order to run this processor, we need to leave enough time in our clock cycle such that we can access the data cache, then do a math operation. And that means our cycle time, which needs to be set based on kind of our worst case is going to be long enough to do kind of our memory work and our execute work together. And if we're doing that, well, we've kind of lost all the advantage of having them be separate pipeline stages. So this is not something we're going to do, even though, yeah, physically we can make the circuit. If we do this, we're losing all the advantage of pipelining in, well, I guess at least the part of pipelining where we said we're going to have a separate execute and separate memory stage, right? We've effectively made them one stage as far as how long is our cycle time going to be, how much sort of throughput advantage are we going to get from pipelining. We've gotten rid of the extra advantage we got by separating the two stages if we do this. So this is not something processors do. And generally, when we've done forwarding, I've been careful to say we're forwarding from the end of one stage to the end of another, because we don't want to increase the amount of time each stage takes. We want to keep that basically the same. If we're thinking like very carefully, we might say, well, you added this thing here, that's gonna take some time, that mux we added, and that extra wire, it's gonna take some time, and that's true, but it's a very small amount of time compared to something like, oh, I'm gonna access a data cache and then do math. So our explanation of forwarding. So we've talked about kind of forwarding and branch prediction. So we have all our ways of resolving hazards. And I gave you this definition that hazards is when the pipeline does, you know, sort of naturally does the wrong thing. And it's common to say, okay, well, it naturally does the wrong thing when one instruction's value is needed by another. And that's true, and that's what we call a dependency. But not all cases of one instruction's value being needed by another cause hazards. So the hazard depends on the details of our pipeline, and you know, is a subset of the cases where we have a dependency. And I want to make sure we're clear about this distinction, especially since we'll be talking more about dependencies when we talk about kind of a more modern processor design than these five-stage type pipeline processors. So let's talk about, have an example here. I have a sequence of five instructions, which I will number here. And question here is, where do we have hazards? Where do we have dependencies? And what forwarding do we end up needing to do? So, if you look on your own, I will write some things I think are useful for figuring this out. Just namely, figuring out what stage these instructions should be in. But figure out, where do we have dependencies? Are they all? Do they all need forwarding to fix? Or are some of them not hazards at all? Who'd like some more time? Three people? Okay, so who can give me one dependency here? Yeah. Okay, 4 depends on 3, and how is that, what's that because of?
That's because in 3, when we bring something into RCS, then in 4, we're adding that value to RCS.
Okay, so that's a dependency. So who thinks that's also a hazard? That's not a hazard? No clue? Okay, so let's think about what happens if we don't do anything special in our pipeline to this move. We're going to write the RCX value here. And if we don't do anything special, we're going to read it there. And on my picture here, time is in left to right. So that's a problem. We're going to write it after we want to read it. And we're going to get the wrong value unless we do something. So this is a hazard. And we're going to fix it with forwarding. We can take the value, for example, from the execute stage of the move and send it to the decode stage of the add instruction number 4. So questions, how I figured that out? Yeah. Sorry? The question is when is that instruction completed? So what do we mean by completed? So the question is, where do we get the constant? So that should be in the machine code for the instruction. So we've retrieved it in the fetch stage. Possibly we might need to do some work to, detangle it from the rest of the instruction, which probably would happen in the decode stage if that extra work was needed. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So if we were moving some value from memory into RCX, then it couldn't be solved with forwarding? Is that my
reference? So the question is, if instead of this being a constant, it was a memory location, would forwarding alone not be enough? Yes. We still would use forwarding, but we use it with stalling in addition. Other questions? So let's see another dependency someone can find for me. Yeah. So you want to say the move queue RCX is dependent on the sub queue RCX, and that's because of what? Because of RCX. So I say this, it follows our pattern, right? All the times we see another receives the same use of a register, this is not what we'll consider a dependency because hopefully we can implement move queue without reading RCX. If we don't do that, well, we might have a false dependency. And yeah, I agree that might be a naive, you might think that's a simple thing, but this is not a real dependency. So this is something that's in this example precisely for this reason, because it's really tempting to just look at the registers and not think about what does the instruction actually do. And unfortunately, that works most of the time, so it's an easy habit to get into. But we have to think here, what does the move queue into RCX do with RCX? The answer is nothing. So there's no actual dependency here. That we don't care if we get the correct value of RCX for that move queue, we're always going to change it anyways. That makes sense? But yes, but this is in this example because it's such a very common sort of thing to think, and it's a reasonable heuristic. You said, oh, just look at the registers. Unfortunately, we need to think a little harder and actually worry about what instructions do, which means that if we have an instruction we don't know, we can't actually do this. But that's how it is. I think there are some additional dependencies here, though, that we haven't identified. Yeah. Okay, so we have this dependency, okay. And we can do our analysis for, is this a hazard? Well, we'd write the value of RBX here. We'd usually read it in the decode of instruction 5. That's not a hazard. That just works immediately. Question? Sorry? Does 5 depend on 4? Yes, 5 also depends on 4. Because of R10. And in this case, R10 is going to be written out off the edge of my picture. And it's going to be read, normally, it's going to be read at the same time as RBX would be. So this is a hazard. And this is one we can resolve by forwarding from execute to the code. Yeah.
Why is that not the same case as like 3 depending, not depending on 2?
Why? Question is, why is it different than 3 not depending on 2? So for it to execute the move, we don't care what the old value of RCX is. We're going to write 100 regardless of what it is. So we don't even need to read any registers to do this move.
But here, are we not reading the smart
pattern? So for the add, we're reading stuff, right? Because we need to know the old value of R10 to do the add for both cases, right? Does that make sense? For the move, I don't care what RCX used to be. Right, I'll get the same result from this move if I put, replace this stuff here with anything else that modifies RCX. Not gonna change how the move works. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so to think about, do we have a dependency, we need to think about does the value matter, not just is the register referenced? Okay, and I think that's all the dependencies. The other sort of case that's in here that I'd like to talk about is that is not a dependency there. Even though we have two instructions both using RAX, they're both just reading it. They don't care what the other does because of RAX. There's nothing that the add instruction number 1 is going to do to RAX that's going to change how instruction number 2 works. Question back there? Yeah. If 3 did depend on 2, would I consider 4 also to depend on 2? Yes, we would say instructions indirectly depend on each other. In this exercise, I was hoping to only learn about direct dependencies. But yes, we could say there's an indirect dependency like that. In which case, we kind of see an example here where 3 affects 5 through instruction 4. But I should have been explicit that I only went direct dependencies. Question? Yeah.
Constant
question for the move queue instruction would be getting that constant from the next instruction. Our assumption is going to be that the fetch stage gets the whole instruction, meaning like everything that appears in that line of assembly is somehow encoded in what we get from the instruction cache. As for how do we do this, the simplest way, and what probably the most popular processors that use this five-stage pipeline design did, is we just make all instructions the same size. And you might say, that means it's hard to have a large constant. Yep. A more complicated idea might be that, you know, if the instructions can be up to 12 bytes, we always fetch 12 bytes and maybe ignore the last few. Does that answer your question? Okay, so we've been looking at this five-stage design because this is kind of the most common early version of these pipeline designs, probably a real implementation. But as we mentioned when we talk about pipelining generally, there's a choice of how many stages do we have, like what kind of maximizes our throughput. And one way the number of stages we have affects things is it changes kind of what hazards we could have, because it changes sort of how many instructions can potentially conflict with each other, and therefore when we would need sort of stalling or forwarding. So for example, if I have a four-stage pipeline, this add instruction is entirely out of the pipeline before we get to the end, some ends to code stage, but that's not true with a five-stage pipeline. You know, and that is going to change when we need to do stalling and forwarding exactly. And generally, a longer pipeline means we have more hazards and therefore more work of forwarding, stalling, branch prediction to resolve them. And to go through this, we'll do a bit this exercise here. So let's say I have my five-stage pipeline where I've said I just had like one box doing math, and let's just assume I've split that up into two pieces. So I have my register read and decode, and I take my math stuff and I just put a register in the middle of it and have two execute stages. And the way this is going to work is because I still have that math circuit, I can't get my results until the execute two stage near the end, and I need to have the inputs available near the beginning of execute one. And this is true even for quote unquote simple operations, because I don't have meaningful values in the middle of the two execute stages. So I have a sequence of instructions here, and the question is what does this execution look like? So I'll give you a little time to start working on this. Question is, are we doing forwarding and stalling? And probably a good first step is to like do our dependency analysis. So we need this value of R9 from instruction 1 to instruction 2. And from instruction 1 to instruction 3, we need the value of R9 computed by instruction 3 for instruction 4. And we also need the value of RBX computed by instruction 2 for instruction 4. And we need the value of R9, no, sorry, we don't. And we don't need the value of R9 that's computed by instruction 3 for instruction 5, because it's just a move. And it doesn't read that second operand. Someone wanted to tell me, what should I do with the instruction number two. So I'm going to try to complete our diagram of sort of what stage things are in and that. Someone back there? Or no? Okay. Yeah.
Another decode.
Another decode. Why? So you're saying, I need the result of the execute from the previous instruction. So that's our first option. We have this dependency in R9. This is the earliest the new R9 is available. And for this instruction, we need that before we can start the execute one stage of instruction two, because it needs to do math on that R9. And so the way we do that is we delay the execute, sorry, the decode stage. We keep the instruction back in decode to, you know, allow us time for that. And this is the earliest it's available. And once it's available, you know, we've waited for it, we're going to forward it. And then we can run the remaining stages of instruction two. So then for instruction three, mentioned this earlier, we're gonna want to, you know, we're gonna try to fetch it in cycle two, and then we'd really like it to go on to the decode stage, but we can't do that because there's something else in the decode stage, so it's gonna stay back in the fetch stage. And then instruction three, we need the value of R9 from instruction one. And well, if we look at our diagram, when we're in the decode stage, it's available. So, but we have to get it via forwarding. It hasn't been written back yet. So we're gonna get it by sending it through forwarding just before we need it in the execute one stage of this, of instruction three. So questions on what I filled out so far? Yeah?
Can you explain the double fetch?
Can I explain the double fetch? So we're always gonna try to fetch a new instruction if we can. So that explains what happens in cycle two. The fetch stage wouldn't be doing anything else, so it's going to be trying to fetch the next instruction. And then we want to go on from a fetch to decode. But here, if we did that, we have two instructions in decode at the same time. And in the processor design we started with, unfortunately, we only have one set of wires here. So you can only fit one instruction in decode at a time. So even though, you know, it would be nice if we could just keep going, it's not going to be an option, so we're going to have to stay in fetch. We can't fetch the next instruction because then we would not be doing instructions in the right order. So we'll just stay in fetch, you know, until we can actually advance to the code. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
Does the PC increase if
we do the double fetch? No. So to implement this stalling, in general, we're going to have to add extra logic to sometimes keep the PC the same.
So it's not like a no-op inserted, right? It's just, it's like you can't see it in the code.
So the question is, it's not like a no-op is being inserted? So if we think about what's happening to the stages of the processor, it's like we have a knob like that's between here that starts executing in the execute one stage. So we can think of that we're kind of filling this gap here with a knob, but only starting at execute one. And so in that sense, a knob is inserted. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So then we get to this move instruction. And when can we fetch the move instruction? We can't fetch it in cycle 3 because on our processor diagram, we look at here, we only have one set of wires here. We can't get two instructions at once. And if we could, we probably wouldn't be just fetching one normally. So we'll have to wait until cycle 4 to fetch instruction 4. And then we'll do the decode, and we need to think about when do we need these values. And RBX, we need in time for the first execute stage. So we need RBX is needed here. So I think about, okay, how do I get RBX? Well, it's been computed, so I can just forward that. We also have R9. And you might say, oh, gosh, R9, we actually need to wait for that. But there's a trick we have, which is that we don't need R9 until we access the data cache. We aren't actually adding anything to R9. We're adding something to RBX, so we definitely need it earlier. But we aren't adding anything to R9, so we can just get it just before we do access the data cache. And so I have it worked out here. So we can do, for example, something like this, where I take the R9 value later and take the RBX value, which we need to do the arithmetic on of adding 8 to compute our memory address, but we don't need to do that with R9, so we can get it later with an additional forwarding pass. And finally, our last instruction, there's no actual dependency on R9, so it can just run, quote unquote, normally without any forwarding or stalling. So questions, how I figured all this out. Okay, so this is kind of our pipeline processor, and you can see that one thing that happens as we try to have deeper pipelines with more stages, I mentioned we had kind of diminishing returns in terms of like, well, we'd have higher overhead from adding the pipeline registers and from not dividing up the stages exactly evenly. We see we also have additional stalling, you know, that kind of really limits the sort of how far we can go with just this pipelining technique. And for our next topic in the course, we're going to talk about things that kind of modern laptop, desktop, and mobile device processors do. And they, you know, start with this pipelining idea, but kind of extend it to fix some limitations of pipelining at the cost of a lot of complexity. So one of the limitations we have is that in this pipelining design, no matter how many stages we have, we can only start one instruction at a time. So an idea that an extension we can do is we can say, well, let's make everything handle two instructions at once. Like we really wanted that earlier anyways. So let's have an instruction cache that fetches two instructions, not one. And a register file that reads two sets of registers, not one set, and so on. And this idea is called multiple issue. And we just make everything bigger, and we kind of handle multiple instructions at once. Now, we still need to do like hazard handling and forwarding for this, and obviously it's going to just get a lot more complicated just because we have more cases. But in this design, we still have the issue that, you know, if I have a slow instruction, we saw how stalling works. We kind of that instruction like needs to wait in decode while everything behind it doesn't make progress. So another kind of fix we do is we say, okay, well, can we do something better than stalling? And we have this idea called out of order, which kind of modern high performance processors implement, where rather than just running the kind of next instruction, we look for an instruction that we can run now. So in this example, we have this dependency between the move and the subtract. And the earliest we can actually run the subtract is after the move finishes, and we have a slow data cache in this case. That's why we have the three memory stages. And what the pipeline designs we saw before would do is they just say, okay, we'll wait and not run any instructions other until that's ready, not advance any instructions past the code. Here, what we do instead is we just find some other instructions that don't rely on that move and start running them. And you might say, what's FDRIE? We'll talk about the stages we're going to use in this processor design and why we have those abbreviations. But the idea is, you know, we say rather than, you know, when we stall an instruction saying that no instructions after it can start, let's look for instructions after it that we can run. And this is kind of the big idea of out-of-order processors, and that's what all kind of modern high-performance processors are. So we have these two things, executing multiple instructions at once, and executing instructions out of order, meaning not in the order they appear in the assembly, but in the order that lets us find work to do. And we're going to talk as our next topic about kind of strategies for like extending our hazard handling to deal with out of order. And we're going to have some implementation tricks to make this actually practical. And kind of the biggest problem we'll get to is that figuring out what value to forward is a lot more bookkeeping. And we really need a systematic strategy to do that. So we're going to talk about like what does that strategy look like, and to talk about why exactly it became more complicated, and also to like motivate our strategy. Let's look at kind of this example here. So with in here we have two options for R8 for the last add instruction here. And we've learned that the one we want to get is the one from the move, the one that's more recent. This is not such an easy thing if we're doing things out of order, because if we're only starting instructions when they're ready, we kind of have this case where if we take whatever instructions and execute that's using R8, that might be an older version of R8 because we're not running the instructions in the same order. So we need to do some bookkeeping to figure out when do we have the right version of R8. And our big trick is that we're going to track different versions of the registers. So rather than just tracking that we're dealing with R8, we're going to write down, I'm dealing with version 1 of R8 or version 2 of R8. So we're going to add an extra preprocessing step where we kind of rewrite our instructions to not just say, this instruction uses R8, we're gonna say, this instruction takes version 1 of R8 and produces version 2, and so on. And this actually simplifies the forwarding later, because when we want to figure out what version of R8 do I get, I don't need to check for multiple. I know if it's version 2, it's the right value. I don't need to think about, could there be another? No. There's only one. So that's kind of our idea. And also, we're going to find out that there's some cases where we actually want to have multiple versions stored at the same time. So what we're going to do to solve this is, we're going to track the versions of the values, and we're actually going to store all the versions in different registers. And we're just going to have a ton of extra registers. So for example, on my laptop, core to implement the 16 registers we see in x86-64 assembly has 168 registers. And the idea is each time you make a new version of a value, we'll just assign it a new register. And this is, in fact, it's kind of the basic idea of how our modern out-of-order processors work, and it's called register renaming. And next time, Professor Campbell is going to go over kind of what that looks like and what this notional pipeline does. You know, this is kind of the design of kind of a modern high-performance processor. We'll talk about, like, what are the components on this picture.